Hello and welcome back to The Other Side of Perfect. I really hope you're enjoying the Christmas break and looking forward to today's show. We have magic man Keith Barry, which I thought was an appropriate episode for the festive season. Keith is a magician, hypnotist, mentalist, escapologist and biometric hacker. He's had a pretty impressive and eccentric career, including acting as the magic consultant for the Now You See Me movies and star of the Discovery TV show Deception with Keith Barry. He's appeared on The Ellen Show and Jimmy Kimmel and also works as a private mind coach with business leaders, sports legends and rock stars on how to unlock the power of the mind. And I wanted to chat to Keith about just that, unlocking the power of the mind, going into superactivity mode, the science behind hypnosis, shrinking the negative in your life and having a cast iron mindset. We also touch on subjects like the subconscious mind, having a hypno birth, the dangers behind his show stunts and hacking into Morgan Freeman's brain. Before we kick off the show, I'd like to say a very warm welcome back to one of our sponsors from Series 1, Clean Cut Meals. If you feel like you've overindulged over the Christmas, first of all, let's have no guilt. You enjoyed yourself and you can get right back on track when you decide to do so. If you do want to get back to some sort of routine for the new year, Clean Cut Meals' new website is now live and they're back taking orders for January. If you want to try out Ireland's leading meal prep service, you can use my discount code Joanne20 for 20% off from cleancutmeals.ie. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's sit down and have a chat with Keith. Keith, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today and to kick off series two of the Other Side of Perfect podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
We're in the Glen Royal Hotel, which is your hometown at the moment.
Yeah, I do a lot of work here in the Glen Royal. I live not too far away. So yeah, it's a great spot. And actually the food is great here as well.
Just, you know, very nice. Them there.
Oh, and I'm gigging here as well.
But okay. We'll talk about that later. Straight in. Just kind of give our listeners a background to you and your career, just in case they don't know. You're obviously a household name within Ireland, but there will be a younger demographic that may be listening that perhaps don't know the extent of what you do. So talk me through exactly what is your career today.
I started off at 5 years of age with a magic set, a Paul Daniels magic set. And Paul Daniels, you might not even know who he was.
I don't.
Yeah, so that's showing my age. I'm turning 43 tomorrow. So ultimately, Paul Daniels way back then was kind of the most predominant magician, certainly in Europe, probably in the world. And he had his own TV show every Saturday night on BBC One, the longest TV series in history, even to date. So anyway, I got a magic set when I was five. That got my interest going. And then when I was 14, I got a really good book on magic called The Klutz Book of Magic. And I got that when I was on a school tour. And then probably about a year after that, I bought a little pamphlet on hypnosis, which got my interest going on hypnosis. And that was called Practical Hypnosis. And I started performing in the public eye right around then when I was 14, 15, started doing everything from kids' parties. I used to do the boats from Rosslare to Roscoff and Cherbourg as the kids' magician. And then it snowballed on from there. But, you know, when I was 18, my parents said magic is great as a hobby. You're going to college. So off I went to Galway to UCG, which is now NUIG, studied chemistry there and became a cosmetic scientist, which basically meant I used to invent women's makeup for Oriflame, which is a Swedish...
Perfect for this podcast.
I know, yeah, right. Yeah, I might know a little bit more about makeup than you think.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when I was 23, I decided I wanted to be full-time in entertainment. So I jumped out of Oriflame, jumped out of cosmetics into being a full-time entertainer. So I actually only thought about it the other day that I'll be 20 years full-time kind of tomorrow, really. And ultimately, you know, I started traveling over and back to the US. I got a TV series here, Close Encounters with Keith Barry, which was mainly magic. So it was kind of close-up magic, street magic, that kind of stuff. But all the time behind the scenes, I was doing hypnosis, helping people with everyday problems that everyday people have. And so that was kind of a sideline business that I was doing at the time. And now I suppose, you know, to bring it up to date, like I've done multiple TV series on multiple networks in the States, in Australia, here, the UK. And, you know, where I am now is obviously I just finished the TV series with RTE. So that went out every Wednesday night. And that was, you know, a great success for both me and RTE. It did really well. It's called The Keith Barry Experience for anybody who didn't watch it. It's up on the player so they can check it out now if they want. And then aside from that, I perform a huge amount live. And then I mind coach a lot of people with their mindset, with performance strategies to optimize their mindset to perform better. And then I've got a TV series currently running in the US on the CW network, and that's called Hypnotize Me, which is a spin-off of the UK TV series I did a couple of years ago with Philip Schofield. So I suppose there's a lot of strands to what I do, but that's kind of the broad stroke, as quick as I can give it.
The condensed version.
Yeah, the condensed version for the podcast, you know.
In terms of magic being, and hypnosis being such a niche industry, what do you think set you apart from other people that haven't made it?
Well, I suppose for me, you know, I kind of look at my brand and I like to have a lot of fun with the entertainment aspect of what I do. So, you know, when I examine other magicians, mentalists and hypnotists out there, I think what kind of sets me apart is especially my live shows. Like, I've been successful on the live circuit for 20 years. And, you know, I realized not that long ago, I hadn't done a TV series of my own here in Ireland in 6 years. So, you know, yes, I'd done You're Back in the Room and those aired here and stuff like that, but they weren't my own projects. And ultimately, even while I didn't have my own TV series for 6 years, I was still doing very well in the live circuit. And that's just because I love, it's not my number one priority, is performing live on stage in theatres. And to set me apart, my job, as I see it, is to make people laugh first and then fool them badly as well. Most magicians and most mentalists, most hypnotists, they kind of flip the formula around. They want to fool you badly. They concentrate on fooling you badly and then hope that you have a giggle or are entertained secondary. My primary focus is the entertainment aspect of it and make people laugh until their faces hurt and then hopefully be fooled badly as well. So that, I think, has been at least part of the key to it, is that formula.
I suppose there's a lull in the room sometimes when it comes to magic because you are essentially fooling people. So there's not that positive feel of immediate humor. People are on edge. They're kind of not knowing what is going to come next and where you're at in terms of controlling their mind.
Yeah, it depends on what it is, you know. So I suppose for me, people, you get skeptics, then you also get people who are just nervous to be around me. Then you get people who are excited when they meet you, they want to see something.
Like the women outside the room, yeah, when like we were setting up.
Yeah.
And I recognize you off the telly box.
Yeah, and I performed something for them when I was waiting down, just down the couch. I met them again and I performed something. Because I'm one of those performers, I'm very happy to perform when I meet people. And very happy to do stuff because I know some other TV performers who I won't name because it'd be unfair of me to do so. But their rule is that they don't perform off the television.
When they're off, they're off.
Yeah, I think that's really bad. I think when you get into this mode of entertainment, like first and foremost, most of us at least get in because we love it, right? It's not a job. It's a passion. And yes, I make money out of it, but I still don't consider it my job. I just think it's kind of sad if they won't perform live. And then you have to question, well, can they perform live at all? You know, and I know some TV performers who definitely struggle performing live.
So you're very comfortable with being consistently on ready to perform.
Yeah, but I'm not always on. I like when I'm in a restaurant with my friends or whatever, or my wife, like we're just hanging out as like normal people. But if somebody comes over and asks to see something, I don't really have to turn it on either. I just do something off the cuff. I just do something fun and interesting. And I love doing it. So it's
so there isn't a struggle to differentiate Keith Barry stage and kind of just now.
No, I think on stage though, you know, I become certainly a super exaggerated hyper form of myself. So on stage, I am on, mm-hmm. You know, whereas off stage, I suppose I'm always on, but like when you're on stage, I'm full on, you know, I turn the energy all the way up and I give it all over the 2 hours. But look, I love performing casually as well. I just think it's a lot of fun, you know.
You've been absolutely hectic over the past couple of weeks. Can you talk me through all the countries that you've been in the past week or so?
God, yeah. Well, it's been a bit mental. Like I was in the States a couple of weeks ago. And then, yeah, this past week has been crazy. So I was in Saint-Tropez last weekend. And this all sounds great, but actually I felt like I was hit by a bus yesterday. But anyway, last weekend I was in Saint-Tropez for 3 nights for a private performance for a 50th birthday party. And then I got back and I had 2 days here with the ESB on Monday and Tuesday. And that was giving my keynote presentation Monday, Tuesday. And then Wednesday, I flew to Timișoara in Romania. So you have to fly through Munich to get there. So a couple hours in Munich airport, flew there. And on the way back, I had to fly through Frankfurt because Lithuanian Airlines went on strike, but specifically in Munich. So I had to change the flight to Frankfurt and then get back. And then I got back late Friday night, and then Saturday morning, got in the car and drove 4 hours up to Derry for a performance up in Derry. And I suppose, and on it goes, you know, this week I'm in Dublin, and I haven't even looked at next week, to be honest, where I am next week. But, you know, I don't take it for granted. I love what I do, as I mentioned. But, you know, yes, there's some downtime in those moments, but predominantly that's all like work, 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 work. Like when I arrived in Saint-Tropez, I had a rehearsal straight away, then I had a 2 hour rehearsal the next day, because the way that was structured was that I had to give 7 20-minute performances at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning, back to back. So 7 25-minute performance, and then I had to do another 25-minute performance that night. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of props involved and trying to change all the shows and stuff. But yeah, it's been a mental week. So I woke up yesterday. Honestly, I could barely move yesterday, just because of the traveling, you know, and you think it won't catch up with you, but it does, you know. But
yeah, and mental exertion as well. As you say, you don't have to try too hard to be on, but you're going from corporate event suitability to private hire to on the road to being you, being happy and positive when you meet people kind of in the hallway of a hotel.
Yeah, and all of the shows that I'm doing are different than each other. I suppose that's the challenge, is that I do so much. So I do keynotes. As I said, I have private clients that I'm squeezing in the middle of that. And then I've got the entertainment aspect, and then the birthday party last weekend, he wanted 7 different 25-minute performances. So that's, you know, whatever, however many hours of material that was. I didn't even count it up, but it was a huge amount of material. So I had to bring over whatever, close to 3 hours of material, I guess. But ultimately, you know, every show is different. So I have a gig this Friday in Sandyford, and I've got to put a bespoke show together for that. But, you know, I think for me, it's just managing time. And, you know, I'm kind of on what I call super activity mode right now. I talk about this a lot in my keynotes, where at various points in my life, and I encourage clients to do this, to go on super activity mode for 2 or 3 months at a time. And I'm kind of in the middle of that now because I'm finishing off the writing of my tour and stuff. And basically, super activity mode is where you sleep 4 hours a night. And ultimately, you can only do it for short periods of time, so 2 to 3 months. But if you follow the system that I have and do it correctly for that 2 to 3 months of super activity mode, you can kind of bounce your business forward about 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
And
so are you working up until quite a late time at night and then getting that stint of 4 hours and then getting up really early and doing the exact same?
Yeah, repeat. Exactly. I kind of go to bed at 2 to 3 and back up at 7. That's kind of where I am now. And because people ask, the people, oh, okay. So like magicians, young magicians ask me all the time, okay, you know, what do I need to do to become a professional magician or earn more money? And I'm like, work harder than everyone. That's it. Outwork everyone. And I same across the board with all businesses. The only difference between is athletes, you know, because athletes, part of their business is to get 7 uninterrupted hours
for the physical side.
Yeah, and I've done sleep studies, so I kind of know a lot about sleep. The optimum amount of sleep is actually 7 hours. If you get a bit more than that, great, but ultimately you don't need more than that. 7 hours is the optimal level, and the athletes are around 20% more inclined to get injured if they get less than 7 hours sleep, so they have to. Whereas for me, I've got to just, you know, be creative, write shows, and, you know, time is obviously of the essence. So when I find that I have so many projects that I'm juggling, I just sleep less. That's it. And work harder. I remember the reason I do that is 20 years ago. I remember, or longer even, Will Smith. Will Smith was just a rapper. And he wasn't really acting much at the time. And I remember he was in an interview and somebody said to Will Smith, what's the key to your success? And he said, when all the other rappers are in bed, I'm up practicing my rapping. That's it. It's as simple as that. So that's what I do. I make sure I outwork everybody to stay on top of the game.
So it's like the analogy of, we all have the same amount of hours as Beyonce in the day, except for you're just adding on those extra hours that Beyonce is probably not sleeping.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, you look at celebrities and you look at their success stories and how you go from kind of rags to riches, and it's consistent hard work, being innovative with your work, whether that's scripted magic material or whether you're singing or dancing, whatever your craft is, and essentially optimizing the peak times to do it when everyone else is doing nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then for me, you know, I'm always conscious of spending enough time with the kids and my wife in the middle of all this. So,
you have two kids, right?
Two, yeah. They're 11 and 7. And for me, you know, I make sure that I, you know, have dinner with them. If I'm home for dinner, I'll have dinner with them. Or just, you know, make time for that hour or 2 hours with the kids and my wife. But then besides that, it's work. For the super activity mode, for that 2 or 3 months, nothing else.
So,
besides maybe going to the gym, because that's part, but I consider that part of my business as well. So I make myself go to the gym. I make myself go to physio because I'm full of injuries. Like I have pretty bad injuries that people don't really know about. So I'm full of injuries. So I just got to keep going to physio as well.
You know? Are these going back to your car crash that you had 10 years ago?
Yeah. So I was actually pretty fit and healthy up until I think it's 12 years ago now. Yeah. The car accident. So I was in a head-on car collision coming back from Jim Aiken's funeral, Aiken Promotions. And ultimately, the other guy was probably doing about 60. I was doing about 60 miles an hour. And it was head-on, no brakes. So you're talking about 120 impact. So our car went into a spin, or my car went into a spin, hit a wall, came back, started to smoke up immediately. But I was trapped because my knee, my tibia, my fibula, my ankle, my metatarsals were all broken. And ultimately, look, it took a long time to get my leg better. They told me I'd have a permanent limp, but I refused that. Like in my head, I was just like, I don't have time to have a permanent limp. So I went through masses of physio, masses of like pain, like you wouldn't believe, to get my leg better. And it's as better as it can be with a 7-inch plate and 13 screws holding it together. I still have arthritis and stuff, but I pretty much block that out now. But because of that, yeah, and because of the escapes that I've done over the years, I've got a degenerative disc in my back. My left leg is still pretty mangled, although I consider it fine, but it's, you know, it's full of arthritis and whatever. And then I've got impingements under both shoulders. And then the latest one that I'm trying to fix now is I've torn my muscle off my rib cage and the cartilage off my rib cage. And I'm not sure exactly when that happened. I think it was probably the New Year's Eve show where I was underwater as part of the RTE show, the New Year's Eve show that I did. So ultimately, I'm 8 months into physio of that, and I've had to have cortisone injections and everything, which I always avoid the injections if I can. But this particular one is so bad that, yeah, trying to get that better. But look, it's part and parcel of life. You know, part of it is due to an accident that I was in that I had no control over. It wasn't my fault at all. It was the other guy's fault. And then part of it is the stupid stuff that I do, the escapology. And I'm not going to stop doing it anytime soon. So then I have myself to blame for that. But I don't moan about my injuries. I only mention that actually that is because I can't understand the amount of people who are have a limp or have a degenerative disc in their back. And I ask loads of people, I say, okay, when's the last time you went to physio? Oh, I tried physio and it didn't work. That's nonsense. You might have tried one physio and their technique didn't work, but you know, for the most part, the human body is very resilient.
And do you think there's a lack of consistency with people like that, that kind of are rejecting the fact that you have to keep up something?
Yeah, well, this is probably an unpopular thing to say, but I think it's a lazy mindset, you know? And I think not enough people are saying that a lot of people have lazy minds and we're being dumbed down by technology. And I find it very frustrating because I can talk about this stuff because I've been in the, like, Gary O'Toole was our ex-Olympic swimmer. I think he's still there. I don't know, but he was in Vincent's when I had my car accident and I went in with my leg and he said it's the worst leg injury that he'd seen aside from a motorbike accident. Like, it was that bad. So I can talk about this stuff and the amount of people that I see that just will put up with a limp or a bad injury or a bad back just because they're lazy. It's a lazy mindset. And I go, okay, well then if you're happy to have that injury and if you're happy, and then they say, well, I'm not happy. Well, then it's your fault. And then they get offended when I say that. And I'm like, well, if you just tried physio twice or you got lazy and stopped doing your physio and you're still injured, then that's your fault. It's nobody else's fault. We dance around this stuff because we all talk about mental health and you can't
say. Well, it's insulting the ego, right?
Yeah. But like, you know, there's a difference between mental health and talking straight to somebody. Yeah, but like a year later after the car accident, our daughter was born in 2008 and she was born with Erb's palsy, which is basically a paralyzed arm. Mm. And we were handed our baby and we were told, we're not sure if it's that's permanent or not. They were very insensitive, actually, but it was basically, we're not sure if it's permanent or not. You know, it's kind of 50-50, but you'll have to just start doing physio and see what happens. Like, that's not even the right mindset of a doctor to tell you that. So we went and we did physio, and I felt like the physio wasn't enough. So then I did my research. Like, I'm not a quack. I don't do this stuff without research. Like, I'm a scientist. So I examined everything from a scientific perspective before I do something or take an action or make an opinion. So I found out everything I could about Erb's palsy, about what caused it, about how you fix it. And ultimately, instead of doing the physio like twice a day, I was doing the physio 12 times a day. And the doctors here were telling me not to do that because you're overdoing it. But through the research that I found out, it was the best possible
option. So this is at-home physical exercises that you can...
Okay. Newborn baby, just moving the arm and doing certain exercises with the arm to try and get it moving again. And ultimately, her arm didn't move for 3 months. So it was pointing towards the fact that it was going to be permanent, but I just wouldn't give up. So, and I stayed regimented 12 times a day. And then 3 months later, her arm started moving again. And she's fine now. So again, I think that was me on superactivity mode back then to fix my daughter, and superactivity mode to fix my leg. And it requires like a cast iron mindset to do that. But I guess I think we all have the ability to have that cast iron mindset. We just need to learn how.
It's resilience is the advice. Consistency. What would you be telling someone to do in that scenario?
Well, it differs for different people. It depends what their goal is and what they want to achieve. But look, I have a lot of different techniques. I think the first thing that I start with is, I talk about shrinking down the negative and magnifying the positive and learning to shut up that negative part of our psyche, you know, because we all have that negative voice. I can't, I won't, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, it's not fair, it's this and that and the other, all these excuses that we make. And we hear that internal voice literally every day. We all do. We all have insecurities. Like, you wouldn't believe, like, some of the CEOs of companies that I work with, some of the athletes that I work with, we all have the same insecurities. Just different people have different abilities to shut down that negative voice. So that's the first thing I do, is I just talk it through with these people and find out what their insecurities are and find out those negative parts that are their psyche, and then teach them how to shrink it down and how to shrink it down subconsciously. Because as a hypnotist and hypnotherapist, I find, and this is just for me, the best technique is using hypnosis coupled with visualization. So, and basically, to break it down, what that means is, you know, really all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. And people sometimes, when they hear the word hypnosis, they go, oh, I'm not so sure about that. But like, hypnosis is now being backed up completely by science. As a matter of fact, I have to Google it today because it's part of my research. But I just saw a snippet the other day where they just performed the first open brain surgery on a person using just hypnosis as the form of anesthetic. And I hypnobirthed our second child with my wife.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. So obviously kind of avoiding painkiller route and literally using hypnosis as the painkiller.
She didn't have an epidural. She didn't have gas, just hypnosis as pain management.
How did you prepare for that beforehand? Was there techniques kind of in the lead up?
Yeah. So it was about 5 weeks in the lead up. So every night at home, I would hypnotize my wife. So, but here's the thing. She's fully conscious and fully aware. Because people, when they think of hypnosis, think, oh, did he put her in some weird trance or something? It's not that at all. It's relaxing down the physical body and relaxing down the conscious mind enough that you can tap in and program your own subconscious mind. So it's not me controlling her. It's her controlling herself in that scenario. And that's the same across the board with hypnosis. Like, I'm not in control. I'm just teaching people how to take control of their subconscious mind. So again, to go back to kind of your original question, you know, that's how I deal with people initially, is, you know, what goals do you want? What's the positive part of even a negative situation? And how do we shrink down the negative and magnify the positive subconsciously? And I teach them self-hypnosis. I teach them how to do it themselves. So with my wife, yeah, it was, you know, tapping into her subconscious and teaching her to use a pain management tool on herself. And, you know, she wasn't, but if she was hooked up to an ECG machine, you would see the fact that she was dumping certain hormones into her body to relax her body down, and serotonin and stuff like that. So chemically, you know, under hypnosis, people change and alter their brains. You know, our brains they're like plasticine, they're like mala, they're like putty. You know, we have the ability to shape and alter our brains because we absorb information that we're constantly around and people that we're constantly around. And then we forget about the things that we're not around. So yeah, so we did that for 5 weeks up to the birth, and then during the birth, yeah, I mean, it was fine. I mean, she's a huge advocate for it now, like herself. Like, if she was here, she would tell you absolutely. But look, you have to have, again, you have to have the right hypnotist and the right relationship with that person in order to make that work, to make sure that it works for you, you know?
You essentially have that trust already with that partnership, yeah. But I'm sure there is an element of people being dubious because of the way that it's been marketed. Whereas essentially what I'm hearing from you is it's an alternative version of mindfulness almost. You're kind of quietening down those 65,000 thoughts that are just rattling around our ego, relaxing the body into a state where it's almost like an empty whiteboard where you can rewrite the program.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very interrelated. Mindfulness, meditation, hypnosis.
Therapy.
Yeah, they're cousins of each other, really. Talk therapy, CBT, all that stuff. And, you know, they're all into, like, even NLP, a lot of NLP people, like, it's so funny to me. There's a lot of courses on NLP, which, for anybody who doesn't know, neuro-linguistic programming. And it became a kind of a fad in the 1980s, 1990s. But ultimately, NLP was all based on the works of a guy called Milton Erickson, who even today is regarded as probably the best hypnotherapist that ever lived and had the best results of anybody who ever lived. And, you know, but it makes me laugh when I talk to NLPers, as they like to be known, a lot of them don't even know that the works of NLP are based on Milton Erickson, whereas I've done my research and I've studied the history of all this different stuff, and I know what techniques work and what don't work. And I'm a huge advocate for absolutely mindfulness, meditation, anything natural that can ease the mind, help you program the mind. Like, I also follow Wim Hof, the Iceman.
The breathing method.
Yeah, and I've done the breathing method. I still do the breathing method. I take cold showers every morning. And all of that stuff, it really, really helps the subconscious brain. You know, I always talk about people being pattern followers and pattern seekers. And we have to learn how to break disruptive behavior patterns and form new behavior patterns. But you can't just do it alone. You got to find a technique that works for you. And, you know, the good news is there's a lot of free techniques out there, and or even some cheap techniques. But the bad news is, as you said, you kind of alluded to it, there's a lot of misinformation out there. So, you know, where do you go? Well, I suppose, you know, for me, it's just finding somebody. Like, if you're going to go to a therapist or a hypnotherapist, it's finding somebody who's got a proven track record, and you check into them and you do your research into them, and start there. I think the issue with a lot of these different areas is pretty much anybody could set up as a hypnotist tomorrow. It's like, it's completely unregulated, which I think is bad. I think it should probably be regulated.
So how does it work? Talk me through, like, is there a certificate for being a hypnotherapist? How does one train to become one and be able to actually practice?
Well, I started off being self-taught. So I just started learning from books and whatnot. I was just doing it for fun. And then when I was in my 20s, I studied with Tony Sadar. He's based out in Cavantilly. So I studied with him as a hypnotherapist, so just studying underneath him, and then I qualified with the National Guild of Hypnotists, the NGH, over in the States. So you have to sit a test for them.
Okay.
So that's where I'm registered as a hypnotist, National Guild of Hypnotists in America. There's various organizations, but, you know, I think the most important thing is that somebody should be certified, at least with one of the bodies, and then obviously then have a proven track record. It's the same, I suppose, with psychology. You go and get a psychology degree. Like, my wife is a psychologist. So like anything, I think there needs to be governing bodies.
Mess with each other's minds all the time.
Me and my wife.
Psychologist.
She's the only person, I suppose, really, who knows how to shut me down pretty quick, because she's onto all my techniques.
She's ahead.
Yeah, not that I do anything knows that all I'm not the supposed secrets. To be doing, but like, yeah. Still, she's like, sometimes I'd be trying something just for fun or whatever at home, NLP or whatever, and she looks at me just and gives me the eye, and then I know she's onto me, so I'm like, okay, whatever, you know.
Yeah, so it's redundant in the end because she's 10 steps ahead, like every woman.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, no, she's 20 steps ahead, actually. Yeah.
What I'm getting from you, aside from being incredibly motivated in mindset and resilient against pain and negative things and circumstances that crop up in all of our lives, there's an element of control that has to be there for the likes of your shows for safety.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're cool with having the bruises and bashes and you know, the war wounds at the end of it. Mm. But equally, how does one monitor and devise the script in terms of the physical aspects of your shows and your dangerous stunts?
Well, you know, for me, you know, I've got a couple of guys that I collaborate with when I come up with the dangerous stunts. you know, I suppose the last danger stunt that I did here was the hanging upside down with the cling film wrapped around my head.
That was off a crane, was that correct?
Yeah, it was about 150 foot in the air, suspended upside down from a crane with a straitjacket on and my head wrapped in cling film. And
just your standard Sunday morning activity.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I suppose it was inspired from Harry Houdini, which every magician looks up to. And Harry Houdini, again, if anybody doesn't know, like he'll go down still and he'll never be beaten as the greatest, certainly escapologist of all time, and probably magician. Like, he was the original guy who could, like, garner thousands of people on the streets to see his stunts and so on. And he single-handedly popularized slash invented the upside-down straitjacket escape. So he would hang off a building in New York upside down, and he would escape from a straitjacket. And it was an amazing feat, because straitjackets are designed to keep insane people, you know, strapped
under
up
wraps.
So they can't hurt themselves or hurt other people. So they're really hard to get out of. But I always thought, well, there's no real point. There's no point to escape in front of it except to show you can escape. So in my head, I was like, okay, why would there be a point? And then I thought, oh, well, if you can't see or breathe and you don't have your arms to help you, well, then that's
it's imperative that you escape.
Yeah, you got to get out. You know, and these things are, there's a huge element of danger to them. I know sometimes when people watch these things, they're wondering, you know, I'm sure it's all going to be okay is what people think. But actually, when I was about to do it for the RTE show, a week beforehand, an Indian magician died doing not the same stunt, but a very similar stunt. Now, his involved water and he ultimately drowned. But people don't know, like, thousands of magicians have been injured, maimed and killed doing the type of stuff that I do. So
is there a plan B, you know, set up for someone like you where, okay, if this happens, I have a signal where obviously essentially you don't want to die from doing a stunt, but do you have kind of a safety net?
Yeah, I'm laughing here because RTE and the producers, rightly so, said, what's our signal to know that you're in trouble? And I'm like,
help.
No, well, I've got cling film wrapped around my head and my arms are tied in a straitjacket. I can't give you a signal. There is no signal. So I just said, look, if I go limp for longer than like 15 seconds, then I'm truly passed out or worse still. So that's just get me down, whatever way you need to get me down. That's it. There's your safety mechanism. And I did have a mini, I don't know if it was a blackout or what it was, but I was so exhausted doing it. You know, I don't really remember, but I did, I think, pass out, or at least close to pass out for about 4 or 5 seconds in the middle of that. And then I came through and got out of the straitjacket and got the cling film off my head.
Do you watch your stunts back? Is it bizarre kind of seeing almost an outer body experience? Because in the moment, you're obviously so tunnel vision and in flow of getting the job done.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I have to watch the stunts back for the edits, so it's because I sit across the edit of all my own TV shows. But ultimately, when I'm looking at it, yeah, I don't remember any of it. Until I look at it, like, you know, because your adrenaline kicks in and really all you're thinking about is staying safe. And, you know, it's kind of looking, when I'm looking at it, it's like looking at it for the first time ever. But look, I don't have a death wish either. So I do put safety aspects in play for the most part. But in the same breath, you know, you have to allow that element of danger to play through and see what happens at the end. You know, but like, as I said, the amount of accidents and injuries and deaths that have happened, it's actually frightening. I'm surprised the book hasn't been completed. Like, there's a book written called 13 Have Died, and that was specifically about the bullet catch where 13 magicians, and we actually know now that it's been more, but at least 13 magicians have been documented as having been killed doing the bullet catch, you know?
I feel like because it's so niche, you don't readily hear about it in the media. I mean, I'm sure in your world you hear about it directly, but I don't think a lot of people listening who attend the likes of your shows would be aware, because I do think they assume there's it'll be grand. This is a TV show.
Yeah, well, I passed out in the Olympia one night and people realized, and I didn't come through too, and people realized relatively quickly that that was not part of the show. And then there was 1,200 people in the Olympia and the curtains just drew closed and everybody's wondering what to do. While backstage, they were scrambling to, you know, get me out of the contraption.
And what had happened?
So it was similar. I'm going back 8 years or somewhere more, maybe. It was similar, but not the same to the stunt that I did with RT. But in this particular show, it was called The Eight Deadly Sins. And this was under the sin of greed. And I would get two random guys up. And it was the end of the show. And I would get two random guys up from the audience, as strong as possible. Or girls, but it was mainly guys, if I'm being honest. And they would tie me up with 100 foot of rope to a chair and as tightly as they could. Because the greed part was, I was offering them €1,000 each. If I can't get out of the rope in less time than they tie me up in, they get €1,000 each. So that was their incentive to tie me as tightly as I could. So I used to get rope burns and all that kind of stuff every night. And then the twist was they would wrap my head in cling film as well, so I couldn't see or breathe while trying to get out of the rope. But this one night, it turned out that the guy I had on stage was a professional sailor, and he tied all kinds of sailing knots, and I couldn't get my hands out. And then some nights I would kick over the chair because you get a bit of slack on the rope. So I kicked over the chair this one night, but I winded myself. And I went to breathe in. I breathed in a load of cling film and I just passed out. And that was it. That was the end of the show right there. Just a guy on a stage and 100 foot of rope with his head wrapped in cling film.
And a sailor getting a new boat from the £1,000.
But madly enough, like as we talk about this, like, who was it? I was just talking to my hairdresser. So I just got my hair cut before I came into it. And
appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. I thought you might have a camera here. So I said, I better get my hair cut. And, you know, I went, you know, to the barber, and I was just talking to him, John Keegan, and I said to John, yeah, I've come up with a great idea for my new tour. And he was like, what is it? And I said, well, I rewatched Shutter Island. So I look at everywhere for research and for inspiration. So I rewatched Shutter Island, which is a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio in it, and they started talking about lobotomies and driving ice picks through somebody's eyeballs. So I'm going to get this contraption made for my next tour, which is Insanity, which all the tour dates are up on keithbarry.com.
We'll leave them in the show notes as well.
Yeah, great. And ultimately, I'm going to get a contraption made where my eyeballs are clamped open, so I won't be able to blink. And then I'm going to get either two drills or two ice picks aimed at my eyes. And then the idea is that I bring up the skeptic. So I'll find a random skeptic from the audience. They come up. And ultimately, if I don't hack into their brain letter by letter, if I get a letter wrong, they click the ice picks closer and closer to my eyeballs, which are clamped open. And they'll be like, we'll just say maybe six clicks. And if they click it the sixth time, the ice picks shoot forward and go through my eyeballs. Now, of course, as I sit here in front of you, I'm thinking, I'm never going to have ice picks go through my eyeballs. But if I get it wrong, and if this guy, if I can't hack his brain, and if he clicks twice or anything, like those are going to go through my eyeballs. So as I said to you, I'm not stupid enough to have that happen. But the theater and the drama will be that actually one night, and people know there's a 0.001% that I could get it wrong or something could go wrong. And ultimately, are you going to be there on the night that Keith Barry gets two ice picks put through his eyeballs? So that's the drama.
Do you think they'll televise that?
I don't know. I haven't pitched this to RTE yet.
I feel like that'd be a curtains down kind of scenario.
Well, the thing is, this is why I love performing live. Because when I perform live, I get to do what I want to do 100% of the time, all the time. So I can do that live.
You have complete artistic license on the night.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, I've also designed this show where I'm going to bring a judge and a jury up on stage. So this is going to be a show for skeptics as well. If you're skeptical, you can come up on stage and be part of the jury to try and catch me out. So we're getting tiered theater style seating for the stage where I bring like 10 or 15 people up into those seats and they get watched closer than the rest of the audience. So I think that's exciting as well. So I've got a lot of crazy ideas for the show Insanity, you know.
So you get your inspiration from anywhere, everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. But I purposely put myself in those scenarios. So like I just bought 25 books on Amazon yesterday for more research and more just ideas. And all I'm looking for is an image or an idea just to get my brain, the creative juices going, and then see where that takes me, you know?
So it's consistent stimulus all the time.
Yeah.
Always looking for an idea.
Yeah, like I'm going to, today after this, I got to get down to a meeting in Kilkenny. And then after that meeting, I'm going to a log cabin place because I want to buy a log cabin. But even when I'm looking at buying a log cabin for my back garden because I need more space.
So this is not for the tour. This is for the house.
Yeah, exactly, for the house. But even when I'm looking at I'll be looking for ideas for the tour while I'm looking at log cabins.
Yeah.
It's consistently always looking for ideas 24/7.
Is that when you're in this high-powered mode for the 3 to 4 months? And then do you kind of regenerate after that where you're not always trying to absorb ideas like that absorbent mind and sponge of a child almost? You're shutting down and recharging the batteries a little bit, or is it just all year round?
Yeah, like I always think that that's a good idea to sit down, recharge the batteries and take that time. I find I just never get that time. So when the tour ends, I'll probably be over in the States doing a TV show. and I'll be straight on a plane there, or, you know, I'll have a lot of corporate work that I'll have to do, or whatever it is. So unfortunately, my schedule never allows that. I do think it's a good idea. You know, you could say, well, you know, just block out 3 weeks and just don't do anything. But, you know, when you're self-employed and you're in the world I'm in, you know, you can't turn work down. You just can't, because you might have a quiet year.
Are you afraid to take the foot off the gas?
No, I'm not afraid. I just think it's not the smart thing to do, to take the foot off the gas. I know some performers who took the foot off the gas, and now where are they? There's been some household names here in Ireland. If we talked about them, people go, well, where's he? Where's she? And ultimately, they took their foot off the gas, which is maybe that was a conscious decision of theirs. But some of them I know, and they would love to still be entertainment. They would love to still be on RTE or Virgin Media or Netflix or wherever. But they just took their foot off the gas for a while, and people forget about you here pretty quickly. So, but for me also, I consider myself an international brand, not just Ireland. So I do a lot of work in the States. I do some work in the UK, do some work in Australia. So I've got to position myself to spend time in those countries, even when I'm not working. So when I'm not working, I'm out in the US pitching for work. Yeah. That's the part I suppose that people don't see. Like I spent a lot of money, we'll just say, on flights last year, going over and back to the States, pitching a TV show, landing a TV show, which actually would have been the biggest deal for an entertainer to ever come out of Ireland for a TV show. Like I had the show, we had the paperwork done, the whole works. But then the network started to put in extra stuff in the contract that I wasn't happy with. So ultimately I had to walk from that show because the deal wasn't right. Now I could have signed it, but I just wasn't willing to sign a bad deal. But that took 12 months of my time and energy, flying over back in the middle of tours, everything.
A lot of people get very disheartened by that, but you obviously took it on the head as a learning experience, went with your gut, wasn't right.
Yeah, and look, like, I suppose this is probably the place to talk about it. Like, ultimately, it was my idea, my concept. I signed it to a production company who now own the copyright on it. And because I walked away from it, they've offered it to another mentalist.
They're going
to
use the model.
Even though it's a hypnosis
show.
No, they'll keep the name and everything. Not even model. Like literally, they're trying to slot in another
carbon
mentalist.
Copy and just hand it to someone else.
Yeah, and go ahead with the project. So that's very disheartening.
And ruthless.
And ruthless. But that's Hollywood for you. And ultimately, that could tear you down. But I have the ability now to emotionally let that go. I didn't years ago, and that was very detrimental to my health.
Do you think that you have, over the years, worked on the ego to emotionally detach from setbacks like that? Or do you think that it's a combination of experience, maturity, age, having a family? Like, what's the element that's kind of made that change?
I've just had so many distasteful and bad experiences in the world that I'm in. And I've just been literally, like, you know, I've just had so many bad experiences that I held on to for so long. And then I figured out pretty quickly that was really bad for me to hold on to that baggage. I just now have the full facility to let it go. Like, full facility.
So it's just immediate offloading. Because I think in this industry, and I would have a taste of a very small percentage, not in the same realm as you, but if you do take on all the setbacks and all the negatives of being an entrepreneur, let alone being in the media industry, you'll just be so weighed down with negativity because you're taking on so many setbacks and opportunities that aren't for you and negative energies from people that perhaps burned you, fecked you over, took your work. You have to almost just agree that that's part of the contract nearly and just accept it that it's part of the role. It's nothing personal. It's not emotion. It's emotionless and it's just factual.
Yeah. And when you're creative, it's difficult to think like that. You have to because, you know, years ago in the US, I had a TV show, TV series. And the producers were just not nice people. And ultimately, every single day there was filming, people were screaming at each other. They were screaming at me and I was screaming back at them. And it was just like this poisonous environment.
Very toxic environment.
And it kind of broke me a little bit, if I'm being honest with you. And I came back here and I was just like, I was broken. And it took me a while to recover from that. But now if I find myself in any kind of scenario like that at all, I have the full ability to let it go. Like, I don't take, like, I won't allow people to talk to me a certain way now. And then B, if the deal is wrong, no matter what the deal is, I'll walk away from it. And I know sometimes people probably listen to a podcast like this might say, well, that's okay for you. Well, actually, it's not okay for me. Like, I burnt my hands on McDonald's toasters. I walked the walk. I lived in a, like, we're in a small room here in the Glen Royal. I lived in an apartment half the size of this whole room with my wife for 3 years. So
I think people forget the prior story because they don't really know it. It's just an assumption that they see where you are now. So it's easy for you to say, but essentially everything is relative.
Yeah, and I've had bad financial years. Even recently, I've had good financial years. For me, like I only mentioned that because I'm not in it for, like, weirdly, I'm not interested in money. We all need money. We need money for a certain level of lifestyle. But, like, you know, for me, I live for experience first and foremost. So that's why I'm willing to walk away from bad deals. And, you know, that's why I'm only interested in surrounding myself by like-minded positive people. So I my rule to myself is, where possible, it's not always possible, but where possible, I only work with people that I like. So, for example, when I go on tour, you know, I know the crew, I know the people that I'm with. If I'm sometimes in TV around the world, sometimes you have to work with, you know, challenging people. But ultimately, you know, for the most part, it's pretty good. But, you know, when you're in control of an environment, for me, I think it's important to, you know, surround yourself by like-minded positive people. So I talked to this about this to CEOs, for example. I'm like, who are you employing? Why are you employing them? You know, as part of the thing that was at, in Timișoara just a few days ago in Romania, that company have it right, I can tell you. They know how to treat their employees. I can already tell by the vibe that their employees are happy, they're having fun, just because they're creating the right environment. And they're all in the workplace positive people. You can't be positive all the time. Like, nobody's 100% positive all the time, all the time. But you have to program yourself to at least be positive most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if negativity creeps in, you have to just try and deal with that as best you can, you know.
And positive experiences, you've obviously had plenty. I want to know about working on Now You See Me as the chief magic consultant. That's obviously a pretty cool role because you're essentially training celebrities and superstars, working with Morgan Freeman, etc. What was that experience like and what exactly did it entail?
So, yeah, I started working on Number One predominantly with Woody Harrelson. So Woody is the mentalist and hypnotist in the movies. So I worked with him for 2 weeks on his character and how to deliver the lines as a hypnotist and as a mentalist. I also worked on the script for about 2 weeks on Number One. But then on Number Two, I worked on the script from day zero. So I was brought in to work with Ed Solomon, who was the writer of the movie. But I worked with him on the writing for 12 months, for a full year. So most of the routines, the magic routines in Number Two, were from me and Ed's minds collectively. And then I had to back up the delivery of those by being on set every day for 3 months. So I went to I was double jobbing at the time. So I was filming You're Back in the Room in London with Philip Schofield and doing Now You See Me Too. So it was filmed in Longcross Studios in London. So I was there every day for 3 months. And that was hands-on with the actors. So I taught Lizzie Kaplan how to produce Doves. I taught Dave Franco the three-card trick. And ultimately, actually, the close-up version of the three-card trick that I taught him didn't end up with the movie. It got cut. But then the jumbo version that I designed with three sets of twins was all filmed in one shot by John Chu. So if you ever watch it again, we actually used the real method that's exposed in the movie first time round. So we didn't use any camera tricks, is what I'm saying, which was great. And then, yeah, I got to meet Morgan Freeman, which is just an amazing experience because, you know, he would definitely be up there as, in my mind, as one of my favorite actors. And I'm sure people agree, he's an amazing actor. And The Shawshank Redemption would be my favorite movie. So
that's, you know, got to be up there as a highlight.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I got really nervous. I don't really normally get nervous anymore as such. I mean, I get healthy nervous before I go on stage. But, you know, Woody Harrelson said to Morgan, you know, Keith wrote all of the mentalism for the movie Morgan, and he's also a mentalist. He can get inside your head. And Morgan Freeman challenged me and said, I challenge you to get inside my mind. And I got really nervous. But anyway, I eventually told him about, it took me a while, but I told him about a childhood friend of his called Boo Boo that he hadn't thought about in 50 years that he used to fish with. And he lost his mind, which was great for me. And we got it all in camera. Well, we didn't record it, but we got photographs. And you can see in the photographs the exact moment that I hacked into his brain, which was great fun, like, you know.
Does it differ when you have an existing personal relationship with them? So say, for example, you're tapping into your wife's brain versus Morgan Freeman. Does it differ in how you approach it?
it depends on whether it's for therapy or for entertainment, because they are two completely separate entities.
So for entertainment, say?
Oh, for entertainment, not really, no. So like, so here's the thing, right? I want you to, I'm getting a pen here, but it doesn't matter if people can't see. I want you to think of something that you've never, ever drawn, okay?
Okay.
And you've got something in mind, yes?
Yep.
Don't tell us what it is, just focus on it. Be honest, did you tell me what this is?
I definitely didn't. No. This is totally on the fly.
Okay, good. So I want you to think of whatever this is, and you're going to tell me what this is. You just won't know what you're telling me, okay? So do you know whether you're right-brained or left-brained?
Right, I would say. So more creative
but
language.
But you know for sure?
No, I've never done any sort of test or anything like that.
Okay,
but
here's a quick test. And people at home could do this test as well. So it's a fun thing that you can all do. I want you to close your eyes. You do it now. Close your eyes if you're listening to this. If you're driving, don't close your eyes. You can do it with your eyes open. But I want you to just very quickly just think of a chair. Obviously, any kind of colored chair that you want. Now open your eyes. Now, did you see the picture of a chair or did you see the word chair?
Picture.
So you're right. You're right brained. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people out there would have just spelled the word chair in their mind, which means they're left brained.
Gotcha.
So that's a quick test. A left brain, obviously, more analytical, more into words and
definitely
numbers.
Definitely right brain.
Whereas right brain. So I want you to think of whatever it is that you've never drawn and just in your mind start to draw it. And then I'm going to make some sketches here, but in your mind start to draw it now. Okay, that was a straight line to begin with. I believe you just drew a straight line in your mind. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Okay. Go correct. And then you kind of went across the way. Okay, good. Keep going. Okay, now you're going back down in your mind. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, good. And this is just real time. It's the first time you've drawn this. Yes, and it's only in your mind. Good. Keep. Now, I'm a terrible artist. I'm just trying to get a sense of what it is that you're drawing. Okay, like that. Okay. It's like there's something above it as well, though. It's like there's something above this. Well, let's do that. Let's do that. Let's do that. Okay, keep drawing. Good. Okay, I've drawn something. I'm not sure of what it is, though, but I'm going to hazard a guess.
Okay.
Okay, I'm looking at my own drawing here for anybody listening. Okay, and I've drawn something that I believe Joanne was drawing in her mind. Okay, for the first time out loud, okay, what did you just draw in your mind for the very first time?
A wardrobe.
What did I draw?
A wardrobe.
There you go.
Okay. Can I leave the room now?
You can run. She's got a lot of more naughty thoughts inside that brain of hers, but we won't say what they are on the podcast.
So can you read people's minds? That's fucking insane.
But what I do is I get people to focus on a specific thought.
I'm not messing that it's actually the wardrobe that I drew in my mind. It's not even like basic. There's details on the top of it.
Well, I'll tell you what, when the podcast goes out, I'll take a photograph and I'll stick it up on my Instagram page and your Instagram page and people will look at it. I'm Keith Barry Official on Instagram, by the way. Follow me there if you want to see some of this crazy stuff that I do.
And you're pretty decent on Instagram. You're quite regular in terms of your updates and stuff,
letting people know. I'm a little bit behind you on the following. So anybody out there wants to follow me, go ahead.
We'll get lots of ladies your way.
Yeah.
your poor wife.
I was a bit late to Instagram. So yeah, I need to get the numbers up. But look, I enjoy Instagram. I actually think it's one of the better platforms. Like for me, like being absolutely straight with you, I enjoy some social media, but like if I could jump off of Twitter, I'd be gone from there in a heartbeat, and I just do Instagram.
I don't use Twitter at all.
Yeah, I think you're right not to.
I mean, feed Instagram through to it and I'll reply and retweet, but I don't use it.
Yeah, so I'm very similar, and the only reason I still have it, it's probably bad for me to say this because there's people out there who probably love Twitter, but for me, I only keep it for the US market. Because they look at Twitter and what I'm putting up on Twitter.
I think it's kind of gone here, but definitely outside of Europe.
I just find it's a very negative place. It's a negative platform. And for me, Instagram is where it's at. I'm still on Facebook. I enjoy Facebook as well. So I mean, it's not on Instagram. Again, I'm Keith Barry Official on Facebook. I put a lot of content up there as well, you know.
I really appreciate you spending the past hour with me, and I will leave all of those links below.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Cheers. So that is it for my first guest of Series 2. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and don't forget to subscribe, give it a little rating or a review on iTunes, and if you feel like doing so, sharing on social media really helps. Just to let you know as well, Keith Barry has now kicked off his Insanity show, which looks to be absolutely epic. I've seen some of his prep for it and it is a crazy ride. So I'll leave a link for his website so you can check out dates and locations if you want to book a ticket. I'll be back in 2020 with the happy pair for the ultimate in positivity and motivation for the new year. So I'll see you next time on The Other Side of Perfect.